Good morning to you. Should we put a price tag on sunshine in the property market? And how could quantifying it impact on future real estate development? It's no surprise that in a temperate country like New Zealand, mostly anyway, sunlight influences people's real estate decisions. But until recently, there's been no exact value attributed to sunshine in the property market. However, the latest modelling using observations on house sales in Wellington between 2008 and 2014 has changed that. It equates each extra daily hour of sunlight exposure on a property with a 2.4% increase in house sale price. So what's the importance of this new estimate? How could it be used? Arthur Grahams is with Motu and the author of the Valuing Sunshine Report. Connell Townsend's the Chief Executive of the Property Council of New Zealand. Hi, Connell.
Yes, good morning, Catherine.
Arthur, we do this informally already, don't we? People, Well, if they're looking to rent a place, they'll factor in, does that get sun? What time of day does it get sun? If they're looking to buy a place, they'll sure as heck factor it in. So what has your modelling done to sort of formalise that?
Yeah, well, so two things. We've formalised it, but let me put this in the context of where it's come from. It's come from one of the National Science Challenges, National Science Challenge 11, which is better building better homes, towns and cities. And a lot of the issues there is how do we design cities and allow planning regulations to improve the quality of cities, enable intensification, etc. And one of the issues in that has been, as we saw in the unitary plan for Auckland, that a lot of people didn't like intensification, you know, and what not surprising, they're going to get a building next to them, it's going to block their sunshine, maybe block their views, etc. So why don't we think about how we should deal with that? And one approach is pricing. Now, no one has been able to put a price on sunshine before, so what we've done is to be able to put a price on what people pay when they buy a house, essentially, implicitly, what they pay for extra sunshine.
So apart from having to put something else on your LIM report or whatever, what do you believe the use will be? Will it be developers saying, all right, now I can see that it is worth this adjustment to the design of my new, by the way, possibly multi-unit property, increasingly multi-unit property?
I'm sure a good developer would already have known this within the same ballpark as what we're doing. So we're not adding particularly to what the developer would know or should know. What I think we're adding is a potential for planners to change their approach to planning within cities. So instead of having inflexible height regulations and setbacks and building envelopes and things like that, instead they can allow that to be more flexible and instead say, well, if you're going to build a property next to another and it's going to block their sunlight, you need to pay them off so much.
I can hear Connell already.
Well, actually, I think it's a benefit to developers because at the moment they just prevented carte blanche from doing
such
developments.
So you're saying, yes, you can do it, but there's got to be some kind of recompense to whom? The existing owner?
Well, that's an interesting question. Who should compensate who?
Can you compensate for sunshine? I mean, you've put a dollar price on it, but someone else says, it's not the dollar price, actually, I just want the sun. And if I don't want the sun, I don't want the property.
Absolutely. But our way of dealing with that at the moment is very inflexible. It's very inflexible planning regulations. So we're opening up another instrument, if you like, another way of thinking about it and saying, well, should we have inflexible planning regulations or should we allow some more flexibility in terms of a price mechanism?
What do you say, Connell?
It's a pretty attractive idea. I think, good morning, Arthur. Look, Arthur's absolutely right. Good developers do understand this. And of course, in the market, these things are always factored in. In fact, it goes even a bit further than that. As part of the unitary plan process, Auckland Council helped build quite a large, complex mathematical model to kind of almost capture the intellectual property that's in a developer's brain. It was called the ACDC model. I forget exactly what it stands for, but I guess AC is Auckland Council. But essentially, all the different factors that were taken into account were brought to bear here, and it was presented as evidence to the unitary plan. And to Arthur's point, the way that our district plans and indeed the whole RMA mechanism works at the moment is incredibly inflexible. It's blunt and quite brutal. Now, the Motu model here is based on Wellington, and I've got some thoughts and observations and slower time on that. But with respect to Auckland, we have a huge target and a catch-up to try and house people. The target back at the time of the unitary plan was for some 400,000 new housing units to cope with probably 1 million people. And the emphasis is all about greater density. So you know, from a developer point of view...
So you see this as giving you a more liberal regime, because if you pay some money when you're developing, you can build where you otherwise wouldn't be able to build, or build something you would not otherwise have been able to build.
To a certain extent, yeah. It's more facilitatory in the sense that Arthur's saying, let the market actually sort this out. But what Motu have come up with here is a kind of a proxy figure, as a bit of a guide to get moving along. Now, I may have some concerns about the actual applicability of the model, but this is an astonishingly fascinating bit of research, and it's pretty rigorous, you know.
I still don't get why the market isn't doing it already. I mean, someone looks at a property and says, I get sun to this time of day, yes, I'm prepared to live in it, but it's going to affect what I'm going to offer. Or I get sun to this time of day and no, I'm not going to buy it because I want sun. It's already doing it.
The answer is that our district plans are so blunt and inflexible, and they conflate a whole bunch of things together. In the Motu report, they, you know, the points made, site coverage and building heights are used as a sort of a proxy for sunlight.
Okay, here's your problem, though, sorry to interrupt, Connell. Here's your problem, because I know it's going to happen. This could be a way to get us some affordable housing into certain developments, because if you've got $1 million or $2 million to throw around, you're going to get your maximum sunshine. But if you haven't, you'll be quite happy, actually, to sacrifice a bit of that to get an affordable property, possibly. But here's the problem with the proposals for intensification in Auckland. You've got existing homeowners going, no, I don't want it. And handing me a few quid is not going to change the fact that I don't want my sunshine blocked.
Very true. But if you look at other similar sort of cities to Auckland, and I'm sorry, we're into Auckland rather than, because this is actually a Wellington-based model. But, you know, in other cities like Vancouver, where they have a slightly different town planning regime, these sort of mechanisms that Motu's hinting at here have kind of worked. Not so much a cash payment at 2.4% value of the building for every hour of sunlight, but in some cases developers, with the help from Vancouver City Council, have gone to other owners and said, OK, you don't want me to build the condo, but I've got approval under the plan, so can we do some deals? Would you like a public library? Would you like a place centre? Would you... So other arrangements can be negotiated, and it's done in a much more
commercial
base.
You're trading away sunshine. It's very interesting. You're trading away sunshine.
Trading away sunshine, possibly in return for a place centre. I don't know. That's just a very trivial example of one case of one building in Vancouver. But the problem with our district plan and our RMA approach is site coverage and building heights are a proxy for everything. It's blanket, it's set, you know, you're only allowed five stories high or whatever. It's so utterly contradictory trying to achieve the targets we want to achieve.
What occurs to me, Arthur, also, is we're moving into, just we were discussing earlier, an age of energy change and the capacity to have solar panels that actually work, and when we get to the point where they can store things and, you know, are becoming more and more feasible for households. Where does that sit with this trade away sunshine business, or indeed that you should be able to intensify in a way that blocks other people's access to sunshine, providing you throw some cash at them? Because isn't that limiting the capacity for transition to solar?
Yeah, that's right. And just to come back to a point you made, Catherine, these are market-based prices. Okay, this is what people will pay when they buy a house implicitly for the sunshine that's there. Now, that may reflect health reasons. You might be healthier in a sunnier house, but just straight aesthetics. And it may be for the reasons that you've just raised, which is for solar panels, etc. That probably hasn't been a big case up till now, especially
but
in Wellington.
You're seeing this as being about allowing a more flexible or a more liberal regime for height and intensification. I mean, that's the case that's being made for it, right?
My point is
it factoring in opportunity cost of solar down the track?
So what you would have to think about then down the track is maybe the 2.4% per hour is not high enough. Maybe it should be higher if that's going to lead to a greater sacrifice of solar power.
Who's interested in it so far? Connell obviously is, but who's interested in using such detailed modelling? Where do you think it'll go from here?
Okay, so we've been talking to officials, and I won't name any particular ones, but in central and we've got local government officials lined up.
I could name them, but anyway, carry on.
And the idea of the National Science Challenge, I should say, is to raise these sorts of new ideas, to sort of put new ideas forward. So I think it's a nice example of a National Science Challenge contributing to, you know, real public policy debate.
Thanks, both of you, Arthur Grimes and Connell Townsend.